or smile and dance around until he has her complete attention. Whatever he's doing is working, because not long after the chess game ends, Bree marches into the game space and makes an announcement. "I'm adopting this child," she says, in a way that makes me think she's been working herself up to it for hours. "I've made my decision. Don't try to talk me out of it." Poor Jin. He's getting it from all sides. He can't win at his favorite game. His daughter's giving him the sort of advice that a parent usually gives to a child. And now his love mate announces she's going to adopt a normal. And not just any normal, but a kid who had to raise himself more or less like an animal. A kid who doesn't know how to talk and never had a bath until Bree scrubbed him clean. "Bree, Bree," Jin says, exasperated. "Don't you Bree me," she answers right back, her eyes flashing. "But you know the rules," he reminds her. Bree crosses her arms. Being angry makes her even more beautiful, which means that looking at her almost takes my breath away. "What I know is that this child needs me, and I need him. Surely there are others who can care for him, his own people." "He doesn't have any people," she exclaims. "And you're not listening. I need him." "What are you talking about?" he asks, genuinely puzzled. "I didn't know it until I saw him standing in our door space. But I've missed raising a child. I love Linnea, and I know that she loves me, but she's never really needed me. Not the way this child does." "Bree, what a terrible thing to say." Linnea steps in, placing a hand on Jin's shoulder. "Father," she says softly but forcefully. "I never call you that. It's a backtimer word we don't use. Nevertheless, you are my father, and Bree is my mother, and I love you both dearly. But what Bree says is true. I was designed to be a master eventually. That means I'm unusually self-reliant, even for a prove. It can't have been much fun raising me." Bree suddenly looks crushed. Tears leak from her beautiful eyes. "I didn't mean it that way," she says. "You were a lovely child, Linnea. It was fascinating watching you grow up. I wouldn't trade it for anything." Linnea rushes to embrace her. "Oh, mother dear, I know you love me, but I understand. I really do." Bree wipes at her tears and laughs. "You've always understood, Linnea, almost from the moment you were born. I've often felt like you were the contributor and I was the child." "Enough," says Jin. "Both of you, please. The problem isn't with either one of you. The problem is with the child. It simply won't be allowed, no matter how much you say you care for him. And as to what the child really wants, we can't know that, can we? Because he can't tell us." Jin crosses his arms, as if he thinks he's had the final word on the subject. But he hasn't. Not quite. Because that's the exact moment when Little Face decides to start talking. "I love Bree," the little boy says, as fierce as a latch boss declaring war. "I love Bree, and Bree loves me." And that pretty much settles the question. Chapter 28. When They Come for Us in the Apple Trees. It's not like Little Face suddenly turned into a chatterbox or anything. He still doesn't talk much. Only when it's very important and he can't make himself understood any other way. Bree says Little Face isn't a proper name, and when he gets a little older, she'll help him choose a real name. Jin pretty much keeps out of it, although I notice he started to treat the boy like his own child. So maybe it will all work out if they can figure out how to get around the rules. Meanwhile, me and Bean and Ryder spend a lot of our time outside. We discovered that the coolest thing in the world is to walk on grass in our bare feet. Grass walking. It feels sort of tickly and smooth and alive somehow, even though it's just this green stuff that grows out of the ground. Bean says she's never seen anything so beautiful, and that the only things she likes as much as grass are the flowers and trees, and maybe the blue sky. "Did they have these things before they invented Eden?" she wants to know. "Oh yes, I think so," Ryder tells her. "They say that before the big shake, trees grew right in the middle of the herb, grass and flowers too." Bean smiles and shakes her head. She thinks maybe it's just backtimer talk, but she's too polite to say so. In my opinion, What's happened to Bean is even more amazing than the stuff that grows out of the ground. Her skin is no longer pale or sick-looking. She's strong enough to run and jump and turn cartwheels, which she hasn't been able to do since she was like 5 years old. I'm a new me, she brags, new and improved. Don't let the proves hear you say that, I warn her. They think they're the only ones who are improved. We're walking, all three of us, along what they call a brook. A brook is like a river, only smaller. And if you stick your bare feet in the clear, cool water, it feels good. Ryder says sticking his old feet in the water makes him feel younger, even though the water makes you wrinkle after a while. How come you're always talking about being old? Bean wants to know. Because I am old, Ryder says. I don't really mind the old part. I'm just worried I won't have enough time to finish my book. Bean nods wisely, as if she expected that particular answer. But would it ever really be finished? She asked. I thought the book was your life, and it would only end when your life ends. Except it won't really end because people will read it and remember, so in a way you'll live forever. At first I think he's offended, but after a while a smile slowly creases his aged face. Thank you, Bean, he says and pats her hand. For what? For reminding me of why I'm a writer. They come for us one day while Bean and me are climbing apple trees. An apple is this truly delicious edible that actually grows on trees, and it always tastes better if you pick it yourself. The only thing better is if your best friend picks it for you. Bean finds the best apple in our tree and hands it up to me. You know what this tastes like when you first bite into it, she asks. No, what? Blue sky. You're zoomed. You ever eat blue sky? No, I admit. Try it sometime, she says. It's apple flavored. There's no arguing with Bean when she gets hold of a silly idea, so I don't bother trying. Besides, I kind of like the idea. I'm also thinking it would be cool if we could just stay in the tree and never come down, which is probably at least as zoomed as thinking that the sky tastes like apples. We talk about everything while we're up in the tree munching on apples. Stuff from when we were kids, and dumb things Charlie said, and what it was like after I got banished, and my adventures with Ryder and the boy, and the rats in the pipe, everything, except one thing. We don't talk about what will happen if we have to return to the herb. We don't want to think about it, let alone talk about it. Because once you've felt grass under your feet and tasted blue sky, well, you never want to go back. We're counting clouds when they come for us. At first we think it's one of the clouds, the way it floats through the air. But as the thing gets closer, it looks something like a floating takvi without the armor. Except unlike a takvi, it doesn't make any noise. Just a soft whoosh as it passes through the air. Later I find out it's called a SkyD, for sky flight device. And it works on some sort of magnetic repulsion deal. I'm thinking maybe Linnea arranged to give us a ride so we can see Eden from the air. But it's not it at all. Not even close. The Skydy comes to a gentle stop beneath the apple trees, hovering just above the grass. The little craft opens, and two proofs get out, big male types designed to have extra muscles. And unlike most proofs, they're not dressed in white tunics. They're wearing what looks like security uniforms, enforcers. They stand under the apple tree and look up at me. One of them goes, are you the normal called Spaz? Yes. You and your companions have been summoned by the masters. You must come at once. Apparently they don't trust us to obey, because when me and Bean get down from the tree, they place us in body cuffs and take us away as if we're criminals. Which, as it turns out, we are. Chapter 29. Say goodbye to Eden. So we get to fly in the SkyD, but it isn't much fun. The enforcers shove us down into the bottom of the vehicle where we can't see anything. And when Bean starts to complain, they go, silence! In a way that makes my stomach melt. So we both shut up until we get there. There is a place called Stadium, Only it's nothing like the ruins of the old stadiums in the Urb, which are huge piles of crumbling concrete and rusted steel. Stadium is really a small, curving hillside that looks like it was scooped out by a giant spoon. When we get there, the green hillside is already covered with people. Proofs, of course. And the enforcers tell us they've all been summoned too, just like us.
So they all arrived in body cuffs, I ask, and one of the enforcers looks at me like I'm some sort of talking animal, not worth answering. The enforcers release the body cuffs, and Bean and me stumble into this smooth black circle at the bottom of the hillside. The surface under our feet is polished like a dark mirror, but not slippery somehow. Ryder is already in the black circle waiting for us. He's holding his walking stick and standing tall in a fresh white tunic. His white beard ruffles in the breeze, and he looks fierce and proud and very old all at the same time. "Don't leave the circle," he warns us. "The edges are charged and you'll get a rude shock."
"Ryder," I say, "what's going on?" Ryder gazes up at the gathering crowd of proofs. There's barely an empty space on the hillside. What makes it really weird is, before this we haven't ever seen more than 5 or 6 proofs in the same place at the same time. Now there are thousands of them out there. We hear the murmur of their voices, and we can almost feel the force of thousands of proofs staring at us, wanting to know who we are and how we dared enter Eden. "What's going on?"
"Judgment Day is here," Ryder says. "A kind of trial, I assume."
"Trial? What's a trial?"
"From the back times," Ryder explains. "It was a way of deciding if you broke the rules and what the punishment should be if you did. The Latch Bosses make all those decisions in the Urb. And since a Latch Boss also makes his own rules, you never really know until you've broken one. And then it's too late."
"They have a different way of enforcing things here," Ryder says. Jin explained it when they came for me. "It seems we've been found in violation of the rule forbidding normals in Eden. Apparently most proofs think we should be banished, and the sooner the better. But before a judgment can be made, all the people of Eden must hear the evidence, make recommendations, and then bear witness to the final decision of the masters."
"Where's the boy?" Bean wants to know, looking anxiously around. "Where's Littleface?"
"Hidden away," Ryder says, keeping his voice low, and making a sign that we should speak no more about it. So Bree hasn't given up on her promise to raise him like one of her own, which makes me like her even more than I did before.
"What about Linnea?" I ask.
"She's in trouble too," Ryder says. "She'll have to answer to the masters." All of a sudden a hush falls in stadium as the gathering proofs go silent. They're all staring at something beyond us, and I turn in time to see what they're watching. Right behind us, a small hill is coming unhinged. I swear that's what it looks like. A section of grass tilts up like a lid, then a circular platform rises out of the ground. The platform seems to be made out of the same mirrored black surface we're standing on, but the shape of it changes and expands as it rises. Then when the whole thing has unfolded from the ground, the platform slowly pivots around until it faces stadium. On the platform, seated in transparent thrones, are the 7 masters of Eden. I know without being told who they are. They seem to radiate power and authority without saying a word or making a threat. Some of the masters are young, but at least 4 of the 7 are quite old. They don't look geezer old like Ryder, with his wrinkled skin and missing teeth, but they have the fragile appearance of old age. Even the very old ones still look perfect somehow, as if age has sharpened their focus on being alive. Standing before them, looking beautiful and angry, but not afraid, never afraid, is our friend Linnea. I try to catch her attention, but she seems to be avoiding my eyes on purpose, like she doesn't want to be distracted. The oldest master rises from her transparent throne and thumps the platform with a long black stick. "Future Master Linnea, to the charge of bringing normals into Eden, what say you?" Linnea faces the hillside as if she wants to respond to the people there and not just to the masters. "What say you?" repeats the old master. Linnea takes a deep breath
and speaks in a voice that somehow carries to the far ends of stadium. I say if saving lives is against the rules, then the rules must be changed. The oldest master thumps her stick impatiently. Explain, she demands. They saved my life, so I helped save one of theirs. Tell your entire story, child, the old master urges. Don't make us drag it out of you piecemeal. Linnea bows to the old woman. My thanks to you, Master Ryla. I'm aware that you've taken a special interest in me, since I will one day sit where you sit and listen as you have listened. I only hope I can do as good a job as you have done. Don't bother trying to charm me, child, snaps the ancient proof. I'm too old to be charmed, even by one so charming and persuasive as yourself. So get on with it. Linnea grins and bows again. My apologies. Let me begin by telling you, all of you, she says, raising her hand to the gathered proofs, that many times I have crossed the zone and journeyed into the herb, sometimes to trade, as some of you have also done, but more often to study the people who live there, the unimproved, the human beings we so contemptuously refer to as normals. From the crowd come murmurs of comment and exclamation. I can see many of them shaking their heads, frowning in disapproval. Such journeys are, as all of us know, discouraged, and for good reason, Linnea admits. There are many dangers in the herb. Violence, disease, toxic smog. But the greatest danger is ignorance. I speak not only of the ignorance of the normals, but of our own ignorance. We despise the very idea of being normal, and yet those who are normal do not despise us for our apparent perfection. She pauses, as if she wants to let that sink in, but I don't see many of the proofs nodding in agreement. Lately there are new dangers in the herb, she continues, pacing about the stage. In some of the latches the leaders have stopped leading. Anarchy reigns. Mobs run wild, burning and looting. And why have the leaders failed? Because we have supplied them with brain probes. Master Ryla bangs her stick. Do you have proof of this treachery, she demands, her ancient eyes flashing. I do, Linnea says. Mind probes have long been forbidden in Eden because we know the dangers. And yet there are those who encourage the spread of probing in the herb. At first I didn't know why this should be. And then the truth of it was explained to me by one of the normals you see before you. She points to Ryder. He bows his head slightly. That old man may not have benefited from genetic improvement, but he knows what he knows. He knows there are those in Eden who wish to see the normals destroyed. And what better way than to encourage them to destroy themselves with brain-rotting mind probes? Many of those on the hillside rise to their feet. Some of them are shouting, although I can't quite make out what they're saying. Again, Ryla thumps her black stick. All fall silent. We will investigate, she says, in a voice as clear as an old true bell. If what you say is true, we will take appropriate action. But what has this to do with bringing normals into Eden? What has this to do with saving your life and you saving one of theirs? Linnea explains about her TACFI getting surrounded when she was trying to pass out edibles to the starving mob. She tells how Ryder risked his own life to distract the mob while she got away. Then she points to me. And this normal, a boy with no parents, a boy shunned even by the lowest of the low, this boy risked his life not only to save me, but to save his sister who was dying. How could I refuse to help when I knew she might be saved if only I could bring her here? There are a few murmurs of agreement from the assembled proofs, but not many. As you can see, she was easily cured by our technology. We have the means to cure almost all the diseases that plague the herb, and yet we don't bother trying. We let them sicken and die. We let them starve. We let their latches burn. Is that right? Is that proper? I say no. I say we must remember that the people we call normal are not so different from ourselves. Heckling comes from the crowd on the hill. Linnea has gone too far. Look at them, someone cries. They're ugly. They're hideous. They're stupid. They're normal. Linnea waits until the shouting dies down and then raises her hand, pointing to her own beautiful face. Is this how we judge ourselves? By our pretty faces, by perfect noses, delicate ears, lustrous hair? Is that why the first engineers risked their lives to improve our chances of survival? More shouting from the crowd. Don't forget brains, Linnea. We're smarter, too. Linnea smiles to herself, as if that's exactly the comment she hoped to inspire. Smarter? Is that what makes us proves? Yes, they shout, yes. Ryla thumps her black stick. Let her speak, she roars. Linnea makes a bow of thanks to the old master. We come to the subject of intelligence, she says, because all of us believe we're smarter than any normal. That makes it easier for us to pretend they're not really human like us. But what if I told you that a normal, a girl of 12, learned the game of chess in less than an hour and then beat one of the top-rated players in Eden? The sounds coming from a stadium mean that no one believes her. They think it impossible that a girl from the herb could be smarter than a man born in Eden. Think about it, people, Linnea shouts, making herself heard above the roar of disbelief. Where do we come from? Our genetic coding is the same. We're all human beings. We all start from the same place, the children of the herb. And some of the herb children don't need any improvement. They're already smart, already intelligent, already gifted. If nothing else, they have the gift of courage. No, the crowd roars. No! Yes, Linnea shouts, raising her fists. Then she points at me and Bean. Yes. Let these young normals be raised in Eden with all of our advantages, and they'll do more than beat us at chess. They'll teach us what it truly is to be human, because they have already experienced something none of you have. They risked everything simply to go on living. No, the crowd roars. No. Yes. Yes, Linnea shouts. She points at Ryder. See this old man? He's lived but half as long as some of you, and yet he has more courage, more imagination than any of you. He must have, simply to survive. Let him teach us. Let him tell us his stories. Let him write that the children of Eden have opened the gates to paradise. The crowd roars back, drowning her out. The old master thumps her black stick. A hush of silence finally descends upon stadium. Stay if you agree, Ryla commands. Leave if you don't. Proves by the thousands stream off of the hillside, leaving it green and empty. Linnea stares at the vanishing crowds as if she can't believe her own eyes. Masters, she finally calls out in a much smaller voice. What say you? The masters quietly confer among themselves for many minutes. Once or twice they look over at the three of us, but their perfect faces give nothing away. When they are done, Ryla thumps her stick three times and then slowly walks to the front of the platform. Linnea, you spoke well, she says. When you are a master, things may change. But for now, the rule must stand. Eden shall be Eden. The masters have spoken. Then she turns her back and walks away. Chapter 30. The Sound of Jet Bikes. 5 hours later, me and Ryder are back in the stacks, and the idea of Eden is already like a dream that starts fading the instant you wake up. The way it went down, we never even had a chance to thank Linnea for all she did, for helping to save Bean and everything. Because as soon as the old master finished thumping her stick, the enforcer shoved us into a taxi, and before you could say proves always win, we were rolling through the zone. First stop was Bean's latch, and they never even let me out to say goodbye. All Bean had time for was a quick kiss on my cheek and a whispered promise. I'll see you again even if I have to walk the pipe myself. Then she was gone, and the TACV was already accelerating, heading back into the zone. From there, we crossed into Billy Bismo's latch, and the fancy prove-built TACV delivered us right to the stack box where it all started. "Home, sweet home," Ryder exclaims when he sees the rotten little cubicle where I ripped him off the first time. The weird thing is, he's not kidding. He really is happy to be back in his old stack box. Mind you, I could have lived my final days in Eden, living the life of luxury, and the smile never would have left my face. But who would finish my book, he says, huh? What's to write about if life is perfect? If you spend all your time lazing about and dangling your old feet in cool streams of clean water? Writers need a challenge. They need to struggle. They need to fight. He's looking over at where I'm crouched, back against the wall, chin on my knees. The little stack box is almost empty, everything gone but the old crate he used for a desk and the thick pile of loose paper he calls a book. The place smells old, and I hate it. The whole herb smells old and used up, and I hate that too. Ryder sees what I'm thinking and sinks creakily down beside me. He strokes his scraggly white beard thoughtfully and then goes, "Don't let the darkness eat you up, son. Think what you accomplished. You wanted to save your sister, and you did. Everything else was extra. Think of it as an experience you'll never forget. Why, you've seen blue sky and green grass, and that blue sky is inside your mind, boy. It's there forever, can't be erased." I groan and bury my face in my hands. "Yeah," I mutter. "What if I want to forget everything? And what does it matter if I remember?" "What does it matter?" he asks, sounding astonished. "Are you zoomed, boy? It just seems so unfair." "Let me remind you. Bean is alive. Little Face is saved. Is that unfair?" he demands. "Is it?" "No." "Then get used to it. You must remember the past because it brings you here, to the right now, today, this moment. And from here you can look to the future. A possible future I never even imagined until we went on our great adventure. I won't get a chance to see that future, but you will." "You're not that old," I say, "so shut up about dying, okay?" Ryder puts his withered hand on my shoulder and says very quietly, "It's not old age that's going to kill me, son." "What are you talking about?" He sighs, and you can tell he's been thinking about this for a while. "Look," he says, trying to explain. "When things go wrong, outsiders get blamed. And riders tend to be outsiders. That was true in the back times, and it's true now, when I'm the only rider left in the world." I look over at him. For some reason, there's a lump in my throat. But why? Why should anybody care about an old pile of papers? If nobody reads, why should they care what you write? He shrugs. "I guess it's better than not caring," he says. "I don't have any of the answers, son. Never did. All I can do is keep asking the questions, keep trying to make sense out of why people do what they do." "Yeah? Well, I wish I'd never been born." "Really?" he asks, like he wants to know. "Why is that?" "'Cause Billy Bismo is going to make me wish I'd never been born, that's why. Because I broke his stupid rules." "Ah," Ryder says. He leans in closer and his voice is old and soft and full of the things he knows. "You've nothing to fear from Billy Bismo, son. You never did." "Oh yeah, why is that?" He looks at me curiously. "You haven't figured it out yet, have you?" "Figured out what?" "Why he's taken a special interest in you." "I don't know what he's talking about. It doesn't make any sense. Billy doesn't care any more about me than he does about any of the other things he owns. Luxury items, mind probes, weapons, warriors, spaz boy, we're all the same. We just belong to him like everything else in his latch." "Rest easy," Ryder suggests. "Things will look better in the morning." "Yeah, right." Kay, my former foster mom, she used to say the same thing. It was stupid then and it's stupid now. Things never look better in the morning. How could they when nothing ever changes? But I'm tired of thinking, tired of trying not to remember. And pretty soon I drift off. And then I'm falling asleep, kind of drifting down into the darkness. Easy, an old voice whispers. Easy. When I wake up hours later, there's a roaring inside the dark. Jet bike engines coming this way. And I know in my heart, they're coming for us. Chapter 31. Fear Itself. The latch is burning. From high atop the stack boxes, we can see the fire glow lighting up clouds of smoke along the dark horizon. The clouds look like angry mouths biting holes in the night. The jet bikes roar like an acid rainstorm, coming closer and closer. There's another sound, too, a kind of high-pitched moaning that follows the jet bikes. Oh, oh, like an evil wind, a furious wind. Standing beside me, Ryder says, things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. Then he grunts to himself as if remembering something important. That's from a poem, he explains. Yeats. The poet himself is long forgotten, but some of his lines live on. Thought I knew what it meant all these years, but I had it wrong. Now I know. We'd better run, I tell him urgently. They're coming this way. Of course they're coming this way, he says, as if speaking to himself. The night blazes in his sky-gray eyes. I tug at his sleeve. Come on! Gently he frees himself from my grasp. Shh, he says. There's nothing to fear. What are you talking about? I plead. Nothing to fear but fear itself, he says. That's from another poem, I think. Or was it a speech? Can't recall. Ryder, we've got to get out of here right now. When he turns to me, his face looks peaceful and oddly young. Listen to me, son. My running days are over, and if I did run away, others would be hurt. You're zoomed, I cry. Come on, you stupid old geese, we can run for the pipe. They'll never find us. Let them burn the whole latch. What do we care? We'll just keep running and running. We'll have lots more adventures, and you can write them down in your book. Shh, Ryder says, hush. Suddenly, the jet bikes swarm into the stack boxes, splitting the air with their furious roaring. Headlights scorch the sky like laser beams, and somewhere close by, a baby starts to cry. This is the end, I'm thinking. The end, the end. Must be 100 jet bikes swarming fast and deadly. The jet bikers howl, firing splat guns in the air as the mob follows them into the stack boxes. A mob like we saw in Mongo's Latch, more animal than human, shrieking and howling, ripping apart anything they can get their hands on. They see Ryder standing high on the stack boxes, and they shriek his name. Wheel him! Wheel him! No, I'm thinking, no. But there's nothing I can do. No way to stop the furious, mindless wave that breaks over the stack boxes. A wave of fists and snapping teeth and empty eyes. Save my pages! Ryder yells to me as the hands grab hold and suck him down into the mob. I try to save them, I do. In the light-exploded darkness, I crawl into his stack box on my knees and gather up the pages of his book, trying to stuff them under my shirt close to my heart. But there are so many pages that some get loose and drift away like the falling leaves of Eden. Empty faces glitter with glee, finding my fear. Snatching pages out of the air, tearing the pages to pieces, stuffing the pieces in their bloody mouths as they scream, wheel, wheel, wheel. And then hands rip open my shirt and seize the rest of Ryder's book, feeding pages to the fire that follows them everywhere. The pages burn and burn and burn. No, I'm screaming, don't. But they're not listening. They can't listen. They don't know how. Hands grab me, carry me away, and throw me to the ground. I'm spitting out dirt and trying to get my breath when someone speaks my name.
Spaz Boy, is that you?
When I roll over on my back, I'm looking up at Billy Bismo. He's got a Shetty blade in one hand and a splat gun in the other, and his eyes are alive with the fire.
Stop them, I beg him. He's just an old man.
Billy uses his Shetty to clear a space. The mob backs off a few feet, and he's able to get to me. At first, I think he's gonna cut me with the Shetty, but that's not it. He wants to tell me something.
Nothing I can do, Spaz Boy. Those proven forces that you brought back, they deactivated all the probes.
What? I gasp.
Ruined the whole deal. Mind probes don't work anymore. You can still stick the needle in your brain, but nothing happens.
Now I get it. Why the latch is burning. Why the jet bikes have come. Because the probes have been destroyed. And somebody has to take the blame. We were with the proof, so it must be our fault.
Wheel, the mob shrieks, wheel.
They've tied a rope around the old man's waist. He's not struggling or anything. His eyes look like he's already a long ways from here. Someplace clean and peaceful and quiet. Someplace where the sky is blue.
Ryder!
I scream out, but he can't hear me or see me. Then I'm begging Billy Bismo. You're the latch boss. You can stop them. Billy does a weird thing. He puts his Shetty blade on the ground and reaches out and touches the side of my face.
Sorry, kid. No one can stop a mob when it wants blood. Not even me.
You didn't even try.
I did what I could, Spaz Boy. They could have blamed you. I made sure it was the old man.
But why? Why him and not me? Billy shakes his head as if he can't believe I'm so stupid.
Because you're my son, he says.
Chapter 32. The last book in the universe.
You're my son.
The truth of it explodes inside my head and turns me upside down and inside out. I don't know my name or who I am. I don't know anything. All I know is I'm running away from Billy Bismo, running into the mob, fighting my way to the old man, screaming for them to stop. It wasn't his fault. Please stop. The crowd melts enough so I can see what's happening. They've tied the rope to the back of a jet bike, and Ryder is hobbling along, trying to keep up. I try to call his name, but nothing comes out. All I can do is follow as they wheel him through the stacks, the mob chanting, "Do it! Do it!" But the jet bikers are taking their time. People from all over the herb have come to see them wheel the old man. They want to punish Ryder for all the bad things that have ever happened. And I see from their faces that Billy's right. No one can stop what's going to happen. A couple of times I try to grab him and undo the drag ropes, but the bangers keep shoving me off. They think it's funny, me trying to free a wheeler. Part of the game. Their eyes are dead cold because they can't feel anything, and if I'm not careful, they'll wheel me too. I don't care if they do.
Don't risk it,
the old man warns me when I make a move.
You're my only hope.
But they burned your pages, I cry, running after him. Your book, they tore it up and burned it. I tried, but I couldn't stop them. Ryder looks back at me and smiles.
The pages don't matter, he says. You're the book now. You're the last book in the universe. Make it a good one.
The bangers finally get bored and decide to end it. They gun their engines. The drag rope yanks at Ryder and he falls, his frail body spinning away from me. They wheel the life out of him then, until there's nothing left but a bundle of rags and the broken bones of my old friend. But I'm not there at the very end. My brain won't let me see it, not the worst part. The last thing I remember is running after the jet bikes. And then the smell of lightning fills my nose, the clean electric smell that comes after a thunderstorm, and the blackness rises up and takes me down. Chapter 33. Spaz No More. When I finally woke up, the mob was gone and the fires had burned out. The whole latch felt empty, but I could see people hiding in the shadows, biding their time until it was safe again, as safe as it ever gets in the herb. I thought about running away. I thought about following the pipe to the end of the world. And then I thought about what Ryder said, and I went back to his empty stack box, but there was nothing left, not even a scrap of paper. So I walked through vacant streets where the buildings were taller than daylight. I walked through burned out blocks that still smoldered and empty ruins that even the rats had left behind. I walked until I found myself at the crypts, the concrete bunker where the bully bangers live. And I went to my cube and stayed there, watching old 3Ds and trying not to remember, staring at the walls and trying not to remember, sleeping and trying not to remember. Nothing worked. I kept remembering. Once a banger came and told me Billy Bismo wanted to see me, but I said forget it. And then one day Billy himself came down and told me how my mother had died when I was born, and he'd put me with a family unit because it was no good growing up with a latch boss for a dad, and he hoped someday I'd understand about that and about everything else too. I understand. I never want to be like you, I said. And he went away and left me alone. Later that night, I did a really strange thing. I went down to the pawn mart and found this old voice writer in a Tronic junk pile covered with dust. There's a lot of gizmos you have to attach, but basically you talk in one end and words come out the other. And so I started talking about the old man and all the things he told me and how he helped me run the latches and save Bean and everything. And after a while, I sort of figured out what he meant about me being the last book in the universe. They call me Ryder now, like they called him. And then one night, I wake up in the dark and know I'm not alone. Who's there? I say to the darkness. A latch runner speaks from the shadows. I'm not here, he says. We never met, understood? All I am is a message. What message? A message from Eden, he says. His voice sounds like the whisper of wind in a clear sky. Someone you know says chalks, and don't forget me, and thank you, and a whole lot more. He grows a little every day, and we love him as our own. Do not despair, my friend. Today is theirs, but the future is ours. Long after the runner vanishes, I can hear Linnea's message echoing in my head, especially the last part about the future being ours. Yes, I'm thinking, yes. I'm writing, yes, yes, yes. This is Jeremy Davies. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Last Book in the Universe by Rodman Philbrick. This program was produced by David Rapkin and directed by Bob Walter. Copyright 2000 by Rodman Philbrick. Production copyright 2000, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.